been secretly gratifying to him that his father left at the very dawn of his triumph and forfeited any claim to his wealth. Eliza probably never knew that after she'd raised his five children, Bill had traded her in for a much younger woman, but she was now better equipped to withstand his loss than she had been a few years earlier. When John Davison died on June 1, 1858, he left her an annuity that lasted through 1865, when she inherited the principal. With two sons drawing income, William was now working under John as a bookkeeper at Hewitt and Tuttle, and with occasional assistance from Bill, Eliza could muddle through on her own. She especially relied upon her eldest son, the wunderkind who seemed capable of anything, and who was as steady and trustworthy as her husband had been feckless and mercurial. Eliza was now in her mid-40s, and photos show a prim, sad, gaunt woman. Divorce wasn't an option for a devout 19th-century woman, and her giddy fling with the handsome young peddler had left her imprisoned in a premature widowhood. Bill had been her sole chance, her crazily squandered bid to escape from rural tedium, and the misbegotten marriage left both her and her eldest son with a lifelong suspicion of volatile people and rash actions. In his trilogy of Frank Copperwood novels, his fictionalized version of the life of the Chicago traction magnate Charles Yerkes, Theodore Dreiser described the uncanny perspicacity about his bosses that distinguished the adolescent Copperwood in his first job as a clerk in a grain commission business. He could see their weaknesses and their shortcomings as a much older man might have viewed a boy's. The remark aptly captures the coolly critical eye with which Rockefeller sized up his elders at Hewitt and Tuttle. He was respectful toward his superiors, but never awed by them, and was always aware of their shortcomings. For the record, he professed great respect for Isaac Hewitt, 25 years his senior, but he was much more caustic in private, referring to him as a disgruntled man, forever entangled in litigation. Despite his youth, Rockefeller soon came to feel that he was being underpaid. When Tuttle quit in January 1857, Rockefeller was elevated to chief bookkeeper, performing at the age of 17 all the tasks formerly discharged by the departed partner. Where Tuttle had earned $2,000 a year as partner, Rockefeller was given only $500. And this vexing inequity was only slightly mitigated when Hewitt raised him to $600 a year by 1858. With the same preternatural confidence evident in his campaign to pay off the church mortgage or oversee the Cheshire Street house, the boy began to trade for his own account, making small but successful forays into flour, ham, and pork. Soon this adolescent businessman was cutting something of a figure on the Cleveland docks, where he was always addressed as Mr. Rockefeller. A variety of factors conspired to bring about his departure from Hewitt's firm. Though his salary grated on him, he waited until the economy snapped back from the 1857 downturn before making his move. In charge of the books, he could see that the firm had nearly been bankrupted by the slump and faced a bleak future, a suspicion confirmed by the fact that Hewitt shrewdly kept his extensive real estate holdings segregated from his stake in the commission house. Big Bill, who always liked to play the freelance banker, had given a $1,000 loan to Hewitt, and when John informed him of the concern's precarious state, he barged into the office and demanded, and got, immediate repayment from Hewitt. John D. Rockefeller wasn't one to dawdle in an unprofitable concern. His career had few wasted steps, and he never vacillated when the moment ripened for advancement. When he asked Hewitt for an $800 salary, his cash-strapped boss dithered for weeks before deciding he could go no higher than $700. Later, Rockefeller claimed he would have stayed if Hewitt had matched his demand, but added, "Even then I was preparing, getting ready for something big." While he and Hewitt were bickering in early 1858, an attractive opportunity arose that settled the issue. Rockefeller had befriended a young Englishman, 28-year-old Morris B. Clark, who worked down the street at a produce house called Otis Brownell. They had been classmates at E.G. Folsom's Commercial College and were also neighbors on Cheshire Street. According to Clark, Rockefeller already had the reputation of being a young bookkeeper of more than ordinary ability and reliability, and Clark proposed that they form a new partnership for buying and selling produce, with each partner investing an initial $2,000, an amount equal to $36,000 in 1996 dollars. Amazingly enough, Rockefeller had saved $800, equivalent to a year's salary in less than 3 years on the job, but he still fell considerably short of Clark's figure. As he brooded over how to raise the money, he was informed by his father that he had always intended to give each of his children $1,000 at age 21. And he now offered to advance John the money. "But John," he added, lest his son expect miracles, "the rate is 10. Having just retrieved $1,000 from Hewitt, Bill might have been looking for a high return on these idle funds. John knew his father too well to plead for a gift and accepted the 10% loan, which was higher than the prevailing rate. So on April 1, 1858, backed up by this borrowed money, John D. Rockefeller left Isaac Hewitt and joined the new partnership of Clark and Rockefeller at 32 River Street. At 18, he was catapulted to a partner's rank in a commission house. "It was a great thing to be my own employer," said Rockefeller. "Mentally, I swelled with pride. A partner in a firm with $4,000 capital." The moment was fraught with meaning for him, and after his first day at work, he went back to the Cheshire Street house, fell to his knees, and implored the Lord to bless his new enterprise. Rockefeller never regretted his apprenticeship at Hewitt and Tuttle, and like many self-made men, lavished a retrospective tenderness on his early years. If anything, he drenched the whole experience in a sentimental syrup that only grew thicker and sweeter with time. Even in 1934, at age 95, Rockefeller tried to rally one grandson with tales of his heroic initiation at Hewitt and Tuttle, his stirring baptism in business. "Oh, how blessed the young men are who have to struggle for a foundation and a beginning in life. I shall never cease to be grateful for the 3.5 years of apprenticeship and the difficulties to be overcome all the way along." Chapter 4. Baptism in Business. When the sign reading Clark and Rockefeller was hoisted atop the warehouse at 32 River Street, the local business community warmly greeted the new arrivals. The Cleveland Leader wrote, "As experienced, responsible, and prompt businessmen, we recommend their house to the favorable consideration of our readers." In this first partnership, success seemed to come quickly and easily to Rockefeller. With a booming traffic in meat, grain, and other foodstuffs circulating through the Great Lakes, he and Clark nimbly bought and sold carloads of produce. As the firm's ambitious circular stated, they were prepared to deal in grain, fish, water, lime, plaster, coarse, fine, solar, and dairy salt. The fledgling firm weathered just enough perils to lend, retrospectively, nostalgic charm to this maiden period. 2 months after opening for business, the partners had to cope with a severe frost that damaged Midwestern crops. Having contracted to buy a large shipment of beans, they wound up with a big semi-spoiled batch, strewn with dirt and rubbish. "When we were not needed in the office, we used to go out to the warehouse, my partner and I, and sort out those beans." This setback didn't detract from the firm's overall performance, for by year's end it had netted a highly respectable $4,400, tripling the income that John had made during his last year at Hewitt and Tuttle. But because of the bean fiasco, John had to turn again, however grudgingly, to Big Bill for a rescue loan. To excel in commodities, it was imperative to offer generous financing, and Clark and Rockefeller advertisements trumpeted to prospective clients that they were prepared to make liberal advances and consignments of produce, etc. With his son, Bill often liked to play sadistic money games and then defended his knavish behavior by citing some warped pedagogical purpose. As he bragged to a Strongsville neighbor, "I trade with the boys and skin 'em, and I just beat 'em every time I can. I want to make 'em sharp." John was by now resigned to the bizarrely commercial character of his dealings with his father. And in his memoirs, he even idealized Bill's lending maneuvers as teaching him valuable lessons. "To my father I owe a great debt in that he himself trained me to practical ways. He was engaged in different enterprises. He used to tell me about these things, explaining their significance, and he taught me the principles and methods of business. As John knew, his father's style as a banker followed a grimly manic pattern of conviviality giving way to Scrooge-like severity. Our relations on finances were a source of some anxiety to me and were not quite so humorous as they seem now as I look back on them, Rockefeller allowed, permitting a smidgen of anger to show. When Bill offered a 10% loan, the real motive was something other than altruism, for he had an infuriating habit of calling in loans at the least opportune time. Just at the moment when I required the money most, he was apt to say, "My son, I find I've got to have that money," John D. recalled in his memoirs. "Of course you shall have it at once," I would answer, but I knew that he was testing me, and that when I paid him, he would hold the money without its earning anything for a little time and then offer it back later. About this continuing psychodrama, Rockefeller later said, in another fleeting moment of candor, "He would never know how angry I felt beneath the surface." An intimate critical perspective on the perverse relations between Rockefeller and his father comes from George W. Gardner, who joined Clark and Rockefeller as a partner on April 1, 1859. Having worked with Clark at Otis Brownell, he was evidently invited into the firm to shore up its capital. Scion of an elite Cleveland family, cut from a different cloth than the self-made men of Rockefeller's early years, Gardner later served as mayor of Cleveland and commodore of the Cleveland Yacht Club. With Gardner's arrival, Rockefeller's name was dropped from the firm's title, and the new partnership was styled Clark Gardner and Company, the ostensible and quite cogent reason being that Gardner's name would entice more clients. Rockefeller always felt uneasy about venting anger or making an egotistical show of protest, and he pretended to accept this demotion with equanimity. "Morris Clark was very pleasant about it," he later insisted, "and he said, 'Never mind, it won't be very long. Before many years, you'll be doing better than any of us.' Yes, he was very nice about it. I made no objection." Yet this stinging blow rankled, as he later admitted. "I considered this a great injustice to me, as I was an equal partner, and Gardner brought in only his share of the capital, but I thought it best to submit." It says much about Rockefeller that he thought it unseemly and unchristian to confess to such understandable feelings of injured pride. Rockefeller was bound to clash with Gardner and Clark, for he was a roundhead among cavaliers and approached his work with unflagging, humorless energy. "Your future hangs on every day that passes," he admonished himself. "Long before I was 21, men called me Mr. Rockefeller," he recalled. "Life was a serious business to me when I was young." The only time he showed any youthful gaiety was when sealing a lucrative deal. Like the resident moral overseer, he felt contempt for Clark and Gardner's easygoing ways and irreverent spirit, and they found this young killjoy both a welcome and grating presence in the office. Afraid that any levity would diminish their chances of getting loans, the 20-year-old sought to stifle the excesses of his older partners. When Gardner and three friends purchased a $2,000 yacht, Rockefeller roundly condemned this extravagance. One Saturday afternoon, Gardner was about to escape from the office for an afternoon sail when he saw Rockefeller hunched glumly over his ledgers. "John," he said agreeably, "a little crowd of us are going to take a sail over to Put In Bay, and I'd like to have you go along. I think it would do you good to get away from the office and get your mind off business for a while." Gardner had touched an exposed nerve, and as he recounted years later to a reporter, his young partner wheeled on him savagely. "George Gardner," he sputtered, "you're the most extravagant young man I ever knew. The idea of a young man like you just getting a start in life, owning an interest in a yacht. You're injuring your credit at the banks, your credit and mine. No, I won't go on your yacht. I don't even want to see it." With that, Rockefeller leaned back over his account books. "John," said Gardner, "I see that there are certain things on which you and I probably will never agree. I think you like money better than anything else in the whole world, and I do not. I like to have a little fun along with business as I go through life." Later on, Rockefeller learned to camouflage his business anxiety behind a studied calm. but during those years it was often graphically displayed. Clark remembered one daring venture when the firm wagered its entire capital on a large grain shipment to Buffalo. With foolish, atypical imprudence, Rockefeller suggested that they skip the insurance and pocket the $150 premium. Gardner and Clark reluctantly acquiesced. That night a terrible storm blew across Lake Erie, and when Gardner came to the office the next morning, a frightfully pale Rockefeller paced the floor in agitation. "Let's take out insurance right away," he said. "We still have time if the boat hasn't been wrecked by now." Gardner ran off to pay the premium. By the time he got back, Rockefeller was waving a telegram announcing the ship's safe arrival in Buffalo. Whether unnerved by the episode or upset at having paid the unnecessary premium, Rockefeller went home ill that afternoon. One suspects that Rockefeller associated the bon vivant Gardner with his father, much to Gardner's detriment. Indeed, Gardner felt an affinity with Bill, relishing his bonhomie and outlandish humor and calling him one of the most companionable and most likable old men I ever knew. He would crack jokes and have more to say in one conversation than John would utter in a week. Gardner was the first of many Rockefeller associates to note the unanswered questions about Bill, who returned to Cleveland at irregular intervals, invariably depositing or withdrawing huge amounts of cash from Clark Gardner. "I wonder what business a man could be in that he would have $1,000 to spare one month and need it the next," said Gardner. Thanks to Gardner, we can date the earliest moment at which we can say with some certainty that John knew of his father's scandalous relationship, if not of his bigamy. The firm was starting to cultivate business contacts in Philadelphia, and it occurred to Gardner that on his next trip there he might solicit information from Bill. "So I asked John for his father's address. He hesitated and finally said he couldn't remember." This immediately puzzled Gardner, who knew Rockefeller had a phenomenal memory, and he asked if he could secure the address from Eliza at lunchtime. After lunch, John never alluded to the matter, and as they prepared to leave that evening, Gardner again inquired after the address. "He flushed up and said he'd forgotten to ask for it when he went home. I pressed him no further and never found out where his father lived." When John began to fathom the depth of his father's duplicity toward his mother, he must have inwardly reeled, and he reacted with the same repressed emotion and steadfast evasion that had served him as a boy. Already Rockefeller was treating his father as the supreme taboo subject, setting a pattern for the unremitting secrecy that would pervade Standard Oil. Photos of Rockefeller from the Clark Gardner period show a tall young man with a vigorous air and alert, penetrating eyes. His tightly compressed lips expressed a fierce determination and a guarded nature. Big and broad-shouldered, he had an incipient stoop that gave him a wary air. Despite his occasional priggish blow-ups with Gardner, he had that sublime self-confidence that speaks with quiet authority. Neatly dressed and well-groomed, Rockefeller was the first to arrive at and the last to leave work each day. In a natural division of labor, Clark took charge of buying and selling while Rockefeller tended the books. Rockefeller seemed destined to succeed as much from his fastidious work habits as from innate intelligence. With the avidity of a zealous auditor, he liked to smoke out wrongdoing and uncover errors. Morris Clark thought John congenial, but too exact. He was methodical to an extreme, careful as to details, and exacting to a fraction. If there was a cent due us, he wanted it. If there was a cent due a customer, he wanted the customer to have it. The portrait, if slightly chilling, also underscores Rockefeller's prudish honesty during this phase of his career. From the outset, Rockefeller had to wrestle with the demons of pride and greed. When rebuffed by a bank officer for a loan, he shot back in anger, "Someday I'll be the richest man in the world." He went through the week cautioning himself with proverbs taught by Eliza, such as, "Pride goeth before a fall," and this spiritual self-scrutiny intensified with his growing wealth. When he rested his head on the pillow at night, he warned himself, "Because you have got a start, you think you are quite a merchant. Look out, or you will lose your head. Go steady. Are you going to let this money puff you up? Keep your eyes open. Don't lose your balance. Had Rockefeller not feared his own capacity for excess, he wouldn't have engaged in such strenuous introspection. As he said, "These intimate conversations with myself, I'm sure, had a great influence on my life. I was afraid I could not stand my prosperity and tried to teach myself not to get puffed up with any foolish notions." It's easy to suppose that Rockefeller's typically sententious style was borrowed from church and first polished by these nightly sermons that he preached to himself. That Rockefeller led an unblemished Christian life played no small role in his business accomplishments, for he appealed to the older citizens in town. During his first year with Clark, he hired someone to look after the books while he took to the open road to drum up business, traveling widely in Ohio and Indiana. Contrary to what one might expect, Rockefeller was a smoothly persuasive salesman. Instead of brashly trying to poach clients from rivals, he modestly outlined his firm's services. "I would go into an office and present my card and say to the man that I supposed his business connections were satisfactory, and that I did not wish to intrude upon him, but that I had a proposition that I myself believed in, and believed it would be to his advantage, that I did not expect him to decide offhand, but asked him to think it over, and I would see him again about it." Orders to handle commodity trades poured in almost faster than he could handle them. "I found that old men had confidence in me right away, and after I stayed a few weeks in the country, I returned home and the consignments came in and our business was increased, and it opened up a new world for me." Rockefeller handled people adroitly and wasn't the cold curmudgeon of later myth. However, he was persistent, which pleased or displeased people according to taste. Previewing a problem that bedeviled the oil business, the commodity business was chronically short of railroad cars to transport flour, grain, and pork. And Rockefeller badgered one railroad official so much that the older man finally wagged a finger at him and snapped, "Young man, I want you to understand you can't make a shuttlecock of me." Rockefeller often related how the firm's best customer once pressed him to violate conservative business practice and advance him money before the produce or bill of lading was in hand. Though Rockefeller refused him, he still tried to keep the customer. But he stormed about, and in the end I had the further humiliation of confessing to my partner that I had failed. Only afterward did Rockefeller learn that the customer's intransigence was a cunning trap set by a local banker to see whether these young men could withstand temptation and hew to their conservative principles. For all his popular mistrust of bankers, Rockefeller owed much of his incandescent rise to their assistance. "The hardest problem all through my business career was to obtain enough capital to do all the business I wanted to do and could do, given the necessary amount of money." The banking system was then weak and atomized. Many Main Street banks were thinly capitalized, and they inspired so little trust that Rockefeller's firm kept spare cash in the safe. Rockefeller got his first extrafamilial loan from a kindly, benevolent old banker named Truman P. Handy, who agreed to take warehouse receipts as collateral. After getting this $2,000 loan, John almost floated down the sidewalk. "Just think of it," he mused. "A bank had trusted me for $2,000. I felt that I was now a man of importance in the community." Handy made Rockefeller swear that he would never speculate with the $2,000, and the young man must have sensed that he had won the first of many influential mentors in Cleveland's financial community. Besides being a bank president, the gravely proper Handy was a Sunday school superintendent, and had sounded out Isaac Hewitt on the young man's character and habits. As Rockefeller realized, his credit rating depended upon reports of his sterling character, just as he had lectured George Gardner, and his status as a mainstay of the Erie Street Baptist Mission Church guaranteed him a friendly reception at banks. Thus, Rockefeller's initial loan shows the close mesh of Christianity and capitalism in his early career. Famously averse to borrowing in later years, Rockefeller was extraordinarily adept at it when he needed the capital. As Clark said, "Oh, John was the greatest borrower you ever saw." In bargaining with banks, Rockefeller gave evidence of his father's wiliness and mastery of crowd psychology. If he wanted to borrow $5,000, he let it be bruited about town that he wished to invest $10,000. This rumor would certify his firm's rock-solid credit while also giving bankers an added incentive to extend him a loan. Rockefeller's need for money only grew during the Civil War, which was a bonanza for the commodity business. As a partner in a Cleveland produce house, John D. Rockefeller was strategically positioned to profit from the war, and for the rest of the century his career seemed to march in perfect lockstep with the progress of American business history. For Rockefeller, the Civil War was principally an opportunity to pile up riches, yet he betrayed intense sympathy for the Union cause and fervently advocated abolishing slavery. As early as his 1854 high school essay on freedom, he had railed against cruel masters who worked their slaves beneath the scorching suns of the South. How, under such circumstances, can America call herself free? As a teenager, he had contributed to several charities that aided blacks. At the time, his anti-slavery views were representative of the prevailing views in Cleveland, which had many relocated New Englanders and was a hotbed of abolitionist sentiment. With its favorable political climate and position as a Big Lake Erie port, Cleveland was a stop on the Underground Railroad that transported fugitive slaves to freedom in Canada, and many of them surreptitiously boarded ships just blocks from Rockefeller's office. When slave hunters invaded the town, abolitionist sympathizers rushed to the stone church on the public square and tolled the bell to alert the populace. In 1860, Rockefeller cast his first presidential vote for Abraham Lincoln, and on the eve of the war he attended meetings that resounded with thunderous denunciations of slavery. Abolitionist fervor was especially widespread among evangelical Christians, who deplored slavery and Catholicism as twin tyrannies, and Northern Baptist congregations warmly received black preachers and lecturers who spoke for the abolitionist cause. So why didn't Rockefeller act on his keenly felt sympathies when Lincoln appealed for 75,000 volunteers after Fort Sumter's fall in April 1861? Why did he turn a deaf ear to the torchlight rallies and street-corner recruiters swarming through Cleveland that spring? "I wanted to go in the army and do my part," Rockefeller said, "but it was simply out of the question. We were in a new business, and if I had not stayed, it must have stopped, and with so many dependent on it." This last sentence hinted gingerly at what must have been the main reason behind his failure to serve: his father's desertion of the family and his own need to sustain it. Though the Union government offered no occupational exemptions from the draft, men were excused if they were the sole means of support for siblings, children, or parents. Though only 21 at the outbreak of the war, John D. was effectively in the position of a middle-aged father responsible for a family of six. Like J.P. Morgan, Grover Cleveland, Theodore Roosevelt Sr., and other well-heeled young men, Rockefeller hired a substitute for $300 and ended up outfitting a small army. One morning, Levi Schofield, a captain in the Union Army and a friend of Rockefeller's, marched 30 raw recruits into his River Street office. They evidently passed muster, for Rockefeller dug into his safe and handed a $10 bill to each of them. "God, but he must be rich," gasped one young man, causing another to reply, "Yes, they say he is a rich man, that he is worth as much as $10,000. For the first time, Rockefeller had triggered fantasies of riches. Alan Nevins has suggested that Rockefeller exaggerated when he claimed to have financed between 20 and 30 soldiers, noting that Rockefeller's ledger itemizes only $138.09 for war purposes. Yet a historian of Rockefeller's Cleveland years, Grace Goulder, pointed out that by 1864 Rockefeller was giving about $300 per year to substitutes and their families, besides his general donations to wartime charities. Since Rockefeller's commodity business depended upon market intelligence and a rapid flow of telegrams from various sections of the country, his office became a clubhouse for the latest battlefield bulletins. He and Morris Clark tacked up two large detailed maps and tracked the war's progress with rapt attention. "Our office became a great rallying place," said Rockefeller. "We were all deeply interested. Men used to drop in often, and we followed the war keenly, reading the latest dispatches and studying the maps." While Rockefeller's brother William also managed to duck service and keep on working, the younger brother, Frank, was both physically and psychologically wounded during the war. Not yet 16 when the war started, Frank was hot-blooded and temperamental. With a wide face, broad forehead, and handlebar mustache, he was very much in his father's mold. Where John had a tidy, inner-directed nature, Frank was quick to yield to impulses both base and noble. A much better mixer than John, an outgoing backslapper, he could be kind-hearted and generous toward friends. Frank had an adolescent yearning for battlefield glory, but was initially thwarted in this storybook aspiration by his family. George Gardner, who always took a jaundiced view of John, claimed that John had coldly declined his brother's request for $75 to enlist in the Union Army. In Gardner's telling, John gave his brother a tongue-lashing. "You would be a wild, foolish boy to go away and waste youthful years that you might utilize in getting a start and making money." When John remained adamant, Gardner advanced Frank the $75, the first of innumerable loans that Frank, professing good intentions all the while, incurred but never repaid. This altercation was the first of many rancorous feuds that poisoned relations between John and Frank through the years. While Gardner might have accurately reported John's words, he omitted some important mitigating circumstances. Frank had already tried to slip off and furtively enlist and had been reprimanded by his father for his secrecy. "Young man," said Bill, "when you go to war, you will say goodbye to the family and go out the front door in broad daylight." It took a certain gall for Bill to get on his high horse on the subject of secrecy and family responsibility. Another factor probably swaying John was that Frank had already been rejected as underage and would need to resort to deception to join the army. To aid his memory, Frank now chalked the number 18 on his soles, and when the recruiting station sergeant asked for his age, he piped up, "I'm over 18, sir." In the end, John relented and paid for his brother's clothing, rifle, and accessories during his 3 years of military service. As a private in the 7th Ohio Volunteer Infantry, Frank was wounded twice during the war, at Chancellorsville and Cedar Mountain, which didn't help his already strained relations with John. It must have seemed terribly unjust to Frank that while he waded through bloody battlefields, his eldest brother was raking in the money at home. He always felt that he had paid a severe price for heroism, while John was rewarded for his self-aggrandizement. Ineffectual and full of self-pity, feeling cursed by bad luck, Frank envied his remarkable older brother, who seemed to succeed at every assignment and moved through his charmed business life with icily inexorable efficiency. The Civil War accelerated the North's economic development, setting the stage for its post-war industrial prowess. It greatly enlarged its industrial capacity, broadening the infrastructure of railroads and telegraphs, coal mines and iron mills, as the economy became more mechanized to meet the unprecedented demand for materials. Sewing machines stitched uniforms for soldiers while reapers harvested grain to feed them. As both sides swiftly conveyed huge armies from one theater of battle to the next, the railroad network had to be modernized and expanded accordingly. To encourage further development, the federal government began to provide land grants, with a dozen railroads ultimately taking title to a staggering 158 million acres. This pell-mell growth played a pivotal role in Rockefeller's career, for the proliferation of railroads enabled him to extract discounts from them by playing one off against the other. The war's psychological impact was equally consequential, as it afforded opportunities for commercial gain on a scale never seen before. The outsized profits garnered from government contracts contributed to a money delirium that long outlasted the war. The Civil War not only generated new fortunes, but bred in countless people an insatiable appetite for riches. As farm boys in uniform were exposed to cities and given titillating glimpses of luxury goods and urban sophistication, consumerism received a huge impetus. Even many men who didn't enter the army abandoned farms and villages during the war and flocked to populated areas with flourishing munition plants. The war enhanced Cleveland's strategic importance for a simple logistical reason. As North-South fighting severed freight routes on the Mississippi River, the East-West routes through the rivers and Great Lakes gained a corresponding amount of traffic. Though Rockefeller and his associates secured no lucrative government contracts, they profited from the enormous inflation in commodity prices and the general business surge. Selling mostly on commission, they dealt in numerous foodstuffs and farm implements. By 1862, their annual profits had soared to $17,000, or almost four times what they had earned during their only pre-war year. One of their 1863 advertisements listed the bountiful produce now heaped in their bulging warehouse. 1,300 barrels of salt, 500 bushels of clover seed, 800 bushels of timothy seed, and 200 barrels of pork. At the end of 1862, Rockefeller eliminated a major irritant when he banished George Gardner from the firm. He later obliterated all traces of Gardner from the oral and written accounts of his life, burying him forever with silence. On December 1, 1862, the Cleveland Herald ran the following item. M.B. Clark and John D. Rockefeller, late of Clark, Gardner and Company, will continue the produce business under style and firm of Clark and Rockefeller at warehouse recently occupied by Clark, Gardner and Company, numbers 39, 41, 43, and 45 River Street. That the firm had now swelled to occupy four separate numbers on River Street attests to its runaway success. While he was still in his 20s, the Civil War had converted Rockefeller into a wealthy man, giving him the funds to capitalize on a new industry then flowering in the northwest corner of Pennsylvania. For all the substantial profits booked by Rockefeller during the war, they would prove mere pocket change compared to the profits flowing from the rivers of black gold, now gushing from wells around Titusville. Chapter 5. The Auction. Long before oil was struck in western Pennsylvania by Colonel Edwin Drake, it had oozed from subterranean springs into Oil Creek, the name dated from the 18th century, mantling the surface with an iridescent scum. The slimy liquid was so ubiquitous that it tainted well water and plagued local contractors drilling for salt. Already in the 18th century, the Seneca and corn planter Indians devised manifold uses for it, employing it for soothing skin liniment, medicine, and even war paint. To extract oil from the creek, they floated blankets or flannel rags on the water, then wrung the oil from the saturated material. Even before Drake's find, Seneca oil had become known as a sovereign remedy for stiff joints, headaches, and other ailments. Around 1850, Samuel Keir gathered unwanted oil from his father's salt wells, bottled it in little half-pint bottles, and marketed it as Keir's Rock Oil. With a touch of the charlatan, Keir touted the all-purpose medicinal properties of this elixir, contending it would cure liver complaints, bronchitis, and consumption. And that was just for starters. One wonders whether Doc Rockefeller flogged Keir's Rock Oil from the back of his buggy. In the 1850s, the whale fisheries had failed to keep pace with the mounting need for illuminating oil, forcing up the price of whale oil and making illumination costly for ordinary Americans. Only the affluent could afford to light their parlors every evening. There were many other lighting options, including lard oil, tallow oil, cottonseed oil, coal oil refined from shale, and wicks dipped in fat, but no cheap illuminant that burned in a bright, clean, safe manner. Both urbanization and industrialization sped the search for an illuminant that would extend day into night, breaking the timeless rhythm of rural hours that still governed the lives of farmers and city folk alike. The petroleum industry was hatched in a very modern symbiosis of business acumen and scientific ingenuity. In the 1850s, George Bissell, a Dartmouth College graduate in his early 30s who had enjoyed a checkered career as a reporter, Greek professor, school principal, and lawyer, had the inspired intuition that the rock oil plentiful in western Pennsylvania was more likely than coal oil to yield a first-rate illuminant. To test this novel proposition, he organized the Pennsylvania Rock Oil Company, leasing land along Oil Creek, a tributary of the Allegheny River, and sending a specimen of local oil to be analyzed by one of the most renowned chemists of the day, Professor Benjamin Silliman, Jr. of Yale. In his landmark 1855 report, Silliman vindicated Bissell's hunch that this oil could be distilled to produce a fine illuminant, plus a host of other useful products. Now the Pennsylvania Rock Oil Company faced a single, seemingly insurmountable obstacle. How to find sizable quantities of petroleum to turn Professor Silliman's findings into spendable cash. It took nearly 3 years for Bissell's company, which soon evolved into the Seneca Oil Company, to dispatch someone to Pennsylvania to hunt for large, marketable pools of oil. To this end, an investor in the project, a New Haven banker named Townsend, enlisted a boarder in his rooming house, Edwin Drake, to travel to Titusville in December 1857. A former conductor on the New Haven Railroad, Drake was a 38-year-old widower who was solemn, rather courtly, and disabled by neuralgia of the spine. Photos present a dashing figure with a full beard, broad forehead, and bright, heavy-lidded eyes. Though he made only a nominal investment in the venture, he was dressed up with the fancy title of president to dazzle the gullible yokels, and was conveniently endowed and permanently entered the history books with the honorific title of colonel. When Drake arrived in Titusville, Oil Creek Valley was still an idyllic place of dense pine and hemlock forest, rich in game. In his stovepipe hat and somber black clothes, the pallid Drake formed a picturesque contrast with this wilderness setting. Despite the enticing traces of oil that stained the creek's surface, the search for significant oil deposits, without geological knowledge of underground oil structures, proved a long and frustrating one. While the locals found Drake charming and sociable and supplied with a good repertoire of stories, they also mocked him as a harebrained dreamer seized by a wild obsession. When he tried to dig for oil, the wells caved in. Then, borrowing a method used for salt wells, he started to drill for oil. In this inhospitable setting, choked with underbrush, it was a feat just to assemble the necessary machinery and erect a strange, tall wooden structure known as a derrick. On Sunday, August 28, 1859, Drake's folly was rewarded when oil bubbled up from a well drilled a day earlier. It was less a matter of Drake discovering oil, its existence was scarcely a secret, than of his figuring out a way to tap commercial quantities in a controlled process so that it could be pumped from the earth in systematic fashion. Drake's feat touched off pandemonium as bands of fortune seekers streamed into Titusville and its pastoral surroundings. Speculators scrambled over the greasy slopes of the creek, leasing acreage from unsophisticated, often unlettered owners. One farmer turned down an offer of a one-quarter royalty and stubbornly held out for a one-eighth share. Pretty soon, derricks sprouted everywhere along the dark, narrow valley, the drilling scarring and denuding the once lush forest slopes. Drilling was the first step in an extended production chain. Within a year of Drake's discovery, a dozen ramshackle refineries sprang up along the creek's steep, secluded banks. Inevitably, this tumultuous activity attracted notice in Cleveland, which had the advantage of proximity to northwest Pennsylvania. Even in those days of slow transport, one could travel from Titusville to Cleveland in a day. Several Cleveland businessmen were already refining illuminating oil from bituminous coal and were naturally interested in a rival method. On November 18, 1859, nearly 3 months after Drake's find, the Cleveland Leader reported on the mad hubbub around Titusville, saying that the oil springs of northern Pennsylvania were attracting considerable speculation, and that there was quite a rush to the oleaginous locations. Among the first Clevelanders descending upon the area was a produce merchant named James G. Hussey, who was a former boss of Rockefeller's partner Morris B. Clark, and he came home with ecstatic stories about the riches to be made. We don't know what Rockefeller thought of Drake's breakthrough at the time, but years later, having harvested his unparalleled fortune from oil, John D. Rockefeller saw a large and providential design in the discovery of Pennsylvania oil, stating that these vast stores of wealth were the gifts of the great Creator, the bountiful gifts of the great Creator. He expressed his gratitude that Colonel Drake and the Standard Oil Company and all others connected with this industry had the opportunity for useful work in preparing and distributing this valuable product to supply the wants of the world. As we shall see, Rockefeller always viewed the industry through this rose-tinted spiritual lens, and it materially aided his success. For his conviction that God had given kerosene to suffering mankind gave him unswerving faith in the industry's future, enabling him to persist where less confident men stumbled and faltered. For all his later evangelical fervor about oil, John D. Rockefeller didn't behold its potential in a sudden revelatory flash, but made an incremental transition from produce to oil. Clark and Rockefeller might have taken on consignment some of the first crude oil shipments that reached Cleveland in early 1860, but it was the friendship between Morris Clark and Samuel Andrews, an Englishman from Clark's hometown in Wiltshire, that drew Rockefeller into the business. A hearty, rubicund man with a broad face and genial manner, Andrews was a self-taught chemist, a born tinkerer, and an enterprising mechanic. Arriving in Cleveland in the 1850s, he worked in a lard oil refinery owned by yet another Englishman, C.A. Dean, and acquired extensive experience in making tallow candles and coal oil. Then in 1860, Dean got a 10-barrel shipment of Pennsylvania crude from which Andrews distilled the first oil-based kerosene manufactured in Cleveland. The secret of cleansing oil with sulfuric acid, what we now term refining, was then a high mystery, zealously guarded by a local priesthood of practical chemists, and many curious businessmen beat a path to Andrews's door. An expert on illuminance enthralled by the unique properties of kerosene, Andrews was convinced it would outshine and outsell other sources of light. Finances were tight in the Andrews household. His wife took in sewing to supplement his income, but by 1862, Sam was plotting to leave Dean and strike out on his own. On the lookout for backers, he frequently dropped by the offices of Clark and Rockefeller. In another instance of the worldly advantages of his religious affiliations, Rockefeller knew Andrews and his wife from the Erie Street Baptist Mission Church. When Andrews started talking about oil refining, the dubious Clark cut short his perfervid talk. "I told him there was no chance, that John and I together did not have more than $250 we could spare out of our business. We simply had enough working capital, together with our credit at the banks, to enable us to make advances to consigners, paying insurance and rent." Stymied by one partner, Andrews barged into Rockefeller's office and resumed his sales pitch. Already so flush that he had invested in his first railroad stock, with cash to spare for the firm, Rockefeller was far more receptive. After one chat with Rockefeller, Andrews went back into the warehouse to badger Clark. "I started to shut him off," recalled Clark. "But when he said, 'Mr. Rockefeller thinks well of it,' I impulsively replied, 'Well, if John will go in, I will.'" With becoming modesty, Rockefeller later interpreted his own role as more passive, even skeptical toward the fateful oil venture, and said that Morris Clark's two brothers, James and Richard, were such oil enthusiasts that he had been railroaded into refining by the combined pressure of the three Clarks and Sam Andrews. Whatever the truth, Rockefeller and Morris Clark pledged $4,000 for half the working capital of the new refining venture, Andrews, Clark & Company, placing the 24-year-old Rockefeller squarely in the oil business in 1863, the year of the Emancipation Proclamation and the stunning Union victories at Gettysburg and Vicksburg. Of the initial $4,000 investment, he said dryly, "It seemed very large to us, very large." Scarcely dreaming that oil would ever supersede their main commodity business, they considered it a little side issue, we retaining our interest in our business as produce commission merchants. As a commission agent distant from the oil wells, stationed at the commercial crossroads of Cleveland, Rockefeller naturally entered the industry as a refiner. As a middleman, he belonged to a new breed of people in the emerging industrial economy who traded, refined, or distributed products in the widening chasm that separated raw material producers in the countryside from their urban consumers. The spot chosen for the new refinery tells much in miniature about Rockefeller's approach to business. He exercised an option on a 3-acre parcel on the sloping red clay banks of a narrow waterway called Kingsbury Run, which flowed into the Cuyahoga River and thus provided passage to Lake Erie. A mile and a half from downtown Cleveland, it seemed at first glance an inauspicious site for the new refinery, christened the Excelsior Works. In these bucolic outskirts beyond the city limits, cows browsed peacefully and trees still shaded the waterway. But for Rockefeller, the inconvenience was outweighed by the fact that it would soon adjoin new railroad tracks. On November 3, 1863, proudly flying the Union colors, a gleaming locomotive of the Atlantic and Great Western Railroad pulled into a Cleveland station decked with bunting and launched a new era, giving the town access to New York City via the Erie Railroad and to a valuable direct route to the Pennsylvania oil fields. Able to ship by water or overland, Rockefeller gained the critical leverage he needed to secure preferential rates on transportation, which was why he agonized over plant locations throughout his career. Before long, a string of other refineries had sprouted along Kingsbury Run. With a population of about 44,000, Cleveland was full of dynamic young men struggling to get ahead, and oil refining presented a rare chance to parlay a small investment into a huge fortune. It cost a pittance, as little as $1,000 or less than the cost of opening a well-stocked store, to construct a small refinery and hire hands to run it. By mid-1863, 20 refineries operated in the Cleveland area and shipped a quarter of their kerosene abroad. At first, the profits came in so thick and fast that everybody, big and small, clever and inept, made handsome profits without the fierce winnowing of adversity, the stern lash of marketplace discipline. Rockefeller sarcastically alluded to these palmy days as the harvest time in which such large profits were reaped by the saloon keepers and preachers and tailors and men from all the walks of life who were fortunate enough to find an oil still. Oil was put to myriad uses during the Civil War, treating the wounds of Union soldiers and serving as a substitute for turpentine formerly supplied by the South. Even on the battlefield, the use of kerosene refined from crude oil spread, and Ulysses S. Grant often sat in his tent, drafting dispatches by the flicker of a kerosene lamp. Later on, Rockefeller became so embittered toward Sam Andrews that he denigrated him, quite unjustly, as the expendable figure in the Standard Oil saga. Samuel Andrews was taken into the business as a poor working man with little or nothing in the early stages when it was difficult to find men to cleanse the oil. He had too much conceit, too much bull-headed English obstinacy, and so little self-control, was his own worst enemy. This verdict, rendered much later, was darkly tinged by intervening events, but in the beginning Andrews enjoyed cordial relations with Rockefeller. Andrews knew nothing of business, but was content to let Morris Clark and Rockefeller mind the office while he acted as refinery boss. Reversing Rockefeller's harsh judgment, Ida Tarbell went so far as to label Andrews a mechanical genius, who had improved the quality of the kerosene and the percentage of it yielded by each barrel of crude oil. In the early days, Rockefeller wasn't so detached from the practical side of refining as when his empire later grew and he withdrew into the impregnable fortress of his office. Devoid of superior airs, he was often seen at Kingsbury Run at 6:30 a.m., going into the cooper shop to roll out barrels, stack hoops, or cart out shavings, reflecting the thrift inculcated by his mother and his puritanical religious upbringing. Since a residue of sulfuric acid remained after refining, Rockefeller drew up plans to convert it to fertilizer, the first of many worthwhile and extremely profitable attempts to create byproducts from waste materials. Shaped by a childhood of uncertainty, he aspired to be self-sufficient in business no less than in life and reacted to a perpetual shortage of barrels by deciding to build his own. Disgusted by a suspicious error in a plumber's bill, he told Sam Andrews, "Hire a plumber by the month. Let us buy our own pipes, joints, and all other plumbing material." The refinery also did its own hauling and loading. Such was Rockefeller's ingenuity, his ceaseless search for even minor improvements, that within a year refining had overtaken produce as the most profitable side of the business. Despite the unceasing vicissitudes of the oil industry, prone to cataclysmic booms and busts, he would never experience a single year of loss. If Rockefeller entered the refining business with some reservations, he soon embraced it as the big, bold opportunity he had craved. Never one to do things halfway, he plunged headlong into the business, and his enthusiasm overflowed into his home life. Sharing a room with Brother William, he often nudged him awake in the dead of night. "I've been thinking out a plan to do so-and-so," he would ask. "Now what do you think of this scheme?" "Keep your ideas till morning," Will would sleepily protest. "I want to sleep." In the pre-dawn dark, John usually chatted with Morris Clark and Sam Andrews at Cheshire Street, where they talked interminably of oil. As John's sister Marianne observed, the older men deferred to him instinctively. They did not seem to want to go without him. They would walk in and visit in the dining room while John was at breakfast. She found the infatuation with oil repugnant, screening out the dreadful carnage of the Civil War. "I got sick of it and wished morning after morning that they would talk of something else." Rockefeller leaped into oil with a zest reminiscent of his absorption in the Baptist Church. He lovingly tended his refinery much as he had swept the chapel floor, a parallel not lost on contemporaries. Said Morris Clark, "John had abiding faith in two things, the Baptist creed and oil." This very old, very young man found boyish pleasure in doing business, and when he captured a large contract, he strutted and whooped with a buoyant step, or cut a small comic caper. As one early associate remarked, "The only time I ever saw John Rockefeller enthusiastic was when a report came in from the creek that his buyer had secured a cargo of oil at a figure much below the market price. He bounded from his chair with a shout of joy, danced up and down, hugged me, threw up his hat, acted so like a madman that I have never forgotten it." These isolated, joyful outbursts only underscored the usual constriction of his personality. Rockefeller's overwhelming influence on the oil industry stemmed from the conflict between his overmastering need for order and the turbulent, unruly nature of the infant industry. In the overheated memories of his enemies, Rockefeller became an omnipresent bogeyman who first appeared in the oil regions, the name given to the area along Oil Creek that encompassed Titusville, Oil City, and Franklin, not long after Drake's discovery. One legend, rehashed by several early biographers, was that Rockefeller went to Titusville in 1860 to represent a group of Cleveland capitalists and advised them to refrain from the business, citing the uncertain flow of oil. "In truth," Rockefeller testified, "I was engaged in the business when I took the trip. That was why I took the trip, to see about a supply of oil for my refinery." To reach his destination, he had to travel first by rail and then by stagecoach to penetrate the dark forests and wooded hills along Oil Creek. Despite the spot's isolation, news of Fort Sumter's fall took 4 days to arrive. So many adventurers descended upon the area that train aisles were jammed with newcomers, while others squatted on the roof. It was no place for the squeamish. To reach the railroad, oil had to be carted in barrels across more than 20 miles of rough backcountry, a trade serviced by thousands of brawling, swearing teamsters with shaggy beards and slouch hats who charged extortionate rates. The Pennsylvania barrel, equal to 42 gallons, remains the industry standard to this day. Sometimes oil-laden wagons stretched in interminable caravans along the rutted roads. Many barrels tipped over and smashed, making the hills treacherous. During wet seasons, the mud grew so thick that teamsters often took 2 horses, one to pull the other out when it invariably got stuck. Horses were routinely lashed to death with heavy black whips as they pulled enormous loads through the black muck. Left to die by the roadside, their hides and hair were eaten away by petroleum chemicals, leaving ghastly corroded carcasses strewn across the landscape. Transport by water was no less revolting. Oil Creek flowed into the Allegheny River, where hundreds of flatboats and steamers handled the cargo traffic. Sometimes oil barrels were loaded on barges and floated down to Pittsburgh on man-made freshets produced by suddenly releasing water stored behind floodgates. Lots of oil was lost by the capsizing of barges and smashing of barrels in the confusion and crush of the rafts, said Rockefeller. By 1863, the Allegheny, befouled with oil, actually caught fire and burned a bridge in Franklin. Tramping the banks, Rockefeller beheld the satanic new world bequeathed by the oil boom, an idyllic valley blackened with derricks and tanks, engine houses and ramshackle huts, thickly crowded together in a crazy quilt pattern. Boom towns appeared briefly, witnessed frantic activity, then vanished as abruptly as they had appeared. Rockefeller saw something slapdash about the industry. "You will remember that the business in its early years was a sort of goldfield rush," he reminisced. "Great fortunes were made by some of the first adventurers, and everything was carried out in a sort of helter-skelter way." Rockefeller represented the second, more rational stage of capitalist development, when the colorful daredevils and pioneering speculators gave way, as Max Weber wrote, to the "men who had grown up in the hard school of life, calculating and daring at the same time, above all temperate and reliable, shrewd and completely devoted to their business, with strictly bourgeois opinions and principles." By the time Rockefeller arrived in the oil regions, it looked as if the oil would be more than a transient phenomenon. In September 1861, two Clevelanders brought in the Empire Well, the first mighty gusher, which rose higher than steeples, in the evocative words of one observer, yielding 3,000 barrels of oil per day. To onlookers, there was something uncanny about this towering jet of oil. So fast did the Empire Well flow that its owners could scarcely find barrels to carry it off, and people came running with pails, dippers, cups, and buckets to scoop up the black gold. A sudden oil glut sent prices skidding to 10 cents a barrel, even as teamsters continued to charge $3 or $4 per barrel to ship it to the railroads. From its first days, the industry tended to oscillate between extremes. Gluts so dire that prices plummeted below production costs, or shortages that sent prices skyward but raised the even more troubling specter of the oil running dry. Among the many tales of Rockefeller's first trip to the oil fields, one told by Franklin Breed, a Titusville producer, has a ring of authenticity. He and Rockefeller rode on horseback through the valley to reach Breed's well, then negotiated the final half mile on foot. As Breed later wrote, "It was necessary to cross a bayou of 5 or 6 feet in width and probably 4 feet deep. This bayou contained sediment, which the oil men took from the bottom of the tanks. This, with mud in the bayou, resembled tar. Spanning the bayou was a 6-inch log. I was used to crossing on it, but Rockefeller declared he could not walk on it. He did, however, and he fell off. He looked up at me with a smile and said, 'Well, Breed, you have got me into the oil business head and ears.'" In talking to the hard-bitten wildcatters, Rockefeller must have seemed standoffish and self-possessed, but he professed to enjoy their company, calling them pleasant fellows, the same type we meet in the mining regions, jolly, good-natured, happy-go-lucky. The description is not without a note of condescension, but he listened closely to what people said and filed away as much information as he could, repeating valuable information to himself until it was memorized. There was humility in this eagerness to learn. As he said, "It is very important to remember what other people tell you, not so much what you yourself already know." However stimulated by the money to be made, Rockefeller was appalled by the loose morals of a place infested with card sharpers and prostitutes, and already dubbed Sodden Gomorrah. "The wildcatters were so rowdy," said a visitor, "that throughout the area you could hear the slap of cards on whiskey-stained tables of groggeries." Another visitor marveled at the universal dissipation and reported, "The orgies in Petroleum Center sometimes eclipsed Monte Carlo and the Latin Quarter combined." For a sober, pious Christian such as Rockefeller, This world of brawny men addicted to vice must have seemed infernal. The oil men walked around in tall boots, leaving black footprints in the brothels, taverns, and gambling houses of Titusville and Oil City. Many flaunted their nouveau riche excesses, wearing high silk hats, diamond stick pins, and gold watch chains. In travelers' reports, it is striking how frequently people resorted to hellish imagery to capture the mood. Rockefeller's trips to the oil regions must have strengthened his belief that he stood four square for virtue in a godforsaken place. As an ardent temperance advocate, he was extremely uncomfortable around drinkers, perhaps one reason why he seldom visited the oil fields. Two stories, both of uncertain authenticity, convey Rockefeller's disdain for the morals prevalent among many producers. One night in Rouseville, a local committee of vigilantes crept up to a flatboat moored to a bank and filled with ladies of easy virtue and whiskey salesmen. At the height of a bacchanal, they cut the boat loose and sent the sinners 20 miles downriver. It is said that Rockefeller thoroughly approved of the action.